Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here, as always, with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson, academic advisor to the stars. Wait, you don't do that anymore, do you?
I do it. Oh, I just do it on campus now.
You do it on campus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not to the stars.
Well,
to the falling
stars. Do we
have
any stars on campus?
You mean besides ourselves?
That's a way to start the podcast. Would you like some academic advice?
Maybe. I could probably.
Maybe you should just finish off your degree?
Here's how I know that we're stars, because we get 5 stars.
We get 5 stars. Oh, what a transition. What a transition.
The guilt trips worked. We have a new round of reviews because basically I pressured everybody to do this. This first one comes from JRob17. JRob17 gives us 5 stars, grab bag thoughts. He says, thank you for the podcast, but you're missing a great selling point with your movie reviews. They are time savers. Both Jared's review of a Christian film and Ross's review of an indie film with subtitles made me so turned off from those movies that I will never watch them. So well done. You all saved me hours of time. I think you should quit your day jobs and review films so we don't have to watch them. You could save us tens and tens of hours. Be a real time saver podcast for all of us. Well, J-Rob, you're just J-Robbing yourself if you're not interested in...
Watch my movie. Just don't watch his.
Babette's Feast. This one comes from, thanks from Granville, New York. Hey, Jared, this is Joel from Granville. Yeah, I know Joel from Granville. The guilt trips. This is up near where, this is Granville, New York, near where I used to pastor in Vermont. We were just a little ways away from each other. The guilt trips on the last podcast worked. Thanks for your labors on the podcast. Grateful for your content. Thank you, Joel. Miss you, brother. Hope I can see you again someday soon. Theology Unit gave us 5 stars and hashtag Babette's Feast for Life. What amazes me, Theology Unit writes, what amazes me about this podcast, other than Ross trashing a truly beautiful film and celebrating Christian cinematic drivel, is the two hosts' ability to avoid the cynicism sometimes prevalent in Christian podcasting and avoid the shallow or unreflective discussion sometimes also prevalent in Christian podcasting. Sometimes the episode sounds trite, episode topic sounds trite, but they provide an incisive perspective. Sometimes the episode topic sounds critical, but they provide compassionate wisdom. For example, the pet peeves episodes were incredibly thoughtful and gracious. It's theological without being erudite and practical without being cheesy. This podcast is for the church in every sense of the phrase. Side note, maybe for a Q&A someday, Professor Wilson, I'm an educator and would love to know how you cultivate a gospel-driven classroom. Oh, that's a good topic for...
I feel like that's a well hashed out review.
It was long and well written and
5 stars.
Very thoughtful. Yeah, that's
I
the
disagree
kind of review.
With the first
of
couple of lines.
You do. You know? Yeah. Cinematic drivel. Mm-hmm. This comes from Nodnarb Turkey Man.
I'm telling you, the names on some of these reviews are amazing.
They're better than the reviews. Nodnarb Turkey Man, 5 stars. Great stuff. Getting ready to start my master's in ministry at Midwestern Online, and I wanted to try and get to know the people of Midwestern better since I will not be on campus. I'm grateful for this podcast, the Heart of Pastoring podcast, the Midwestern Chapel podcast. It has been great for my continual effort to know my Lord better and grow closer to Him so I can serve Him better. This podcast has given me great spiritual information, positivity, and also some good laughs. And that is so important considering today's culture and secular media, which is normally the opposite. May God bless you and this ministry, and thank you for it. It is making a difference for the kingdom. Brandon, thanks so much, brother. Really appreciate that. This review comes from Shrockinator. Shrockinator gives us 5 stars. Awesome and free.
Yeah.
One of the few... Oh, I love this.
Yeah, I thought this was great.
Shrockinator says, one of the few two guys in a mic podcast that I really enjoy, and their theology is spot on. This podcast is so good. I can't believe it's free.
I feel like we should rename the podcast, not For the Church podcast, but Two guys and a mic.
That I don't think anyone would subscribe to that.
No. Also, yeah. It's technically two mics as well, if we wanted to be really technical. Oh,
technically at the table, there's three mics, yeah. But only two are in use.
Is that for the spirit's presence?
That's for Elijah. We got an empty seat for Elijah. M.S. Meyer, five stars, great podcast. This podcast has the perfect balance of light banter, theological depth, and practical application. ! Thank you, M.S. Meyer. And this one comes from Jacob Thomas 501, responding to the guilt. Five stars. I'm just following Jared's orders in lieu of the recent review drought. As a young pastor, this resource has always been insightful, encouraging, and full of practical wisdom. Keep up the great work, guys. Trenton 081987, excellent. Five stars. He just writes, Christ-centered podcast! ! D. Triller. D. Triller says, biblical, pastoral, thoughtful. Five stars. Jared and Ross always bring great advice and wisdom to all sorts of really interesting and important topics that edify and encourage pastors and those in ministry. Highly recommended. Look, so you just put a little guilt trip on people. And I mean, that was like a deluge of reviews.
Yeah. My question comes back to, though, why do we have to do a guilt trip to do it? Just keep them rolling in.
You know what? The podcast is free. The reviews should be free. They should be freely given.
Freely given, no guilt given, which means just get on and do it.
You have freely received.
To be fair, I have actually talked to a lot of people recently, you know, countless numbers that would say they're on Spotify and they just do like five stars and they don't do a written review.
I gotcha.
So I do meet a lot of people that listen on Spotify. And my thing was at the end of it last year, I said, who has the For the Church podcast as their number one podcast they listen to? And guys did like send a picture saying they were like the number one podcast they listen to and things like that.
Okay.
And then I saw what the other things that we're listening to as well, because they would do like a screenshot and I would think, really? We're in that group of podcasts you listen to. I mean, I'll take it, but really?
Interesting. So, yeah. Well, the Spotify people will get a special dispensation, I guess.
Sure.
But if you're on Apple Podcasts,
your reward in heaven is great.
If you have the opportunity to write us just two lines, you know, you really should do
that. If you're listening on Spotify, because you can't write a review, why not share an episode and write us on review through social media?
Yeah. Social media is the next step. I don't know how much guilt I got to lay on for people to actually talk us up on Twitter and Facebook and stuff. But that's the next phase. Like, if we want to be up in the Osteen echelon, you know, like if we want to be up in that top religion podcasts, we need some of these people to get off their laurels and start talking about us on social media. maybe that didn't change their minds. I don't know. But today we're talking about changing minds.
Yes, we are. I'm really looking forward to this.
Okay. Oh, you have a stack of books here.
I got a stack of books.
Today's topic is books that changed our minds. Mm. And this was inspired by a tweet from someone a few weeks ago that just said, what's a book that changed your mind? And there were a lot of people commenting. I thought, that's actually a pretty good topic for
because normally books, you like books, they reaffirm what you already think.
Yes.
Maybe there's a line in there you think, oh, that might change a view or something. But the idea of a book actually changing your mind from a yes to a no to a yes, that's quite rare, I think, for a book to do that.
A few of mine, so I've got a little list here. A few of mine are more about like maybe way stations on a journey through my mind change about certain things.
Yep.
A couple of them are sort of like the decisive thing, but some of them are just sort of, this got me out of my old mode of thinking and into a new mode of thinking, perhaps. Yeah. So
should we do like one about?
Yeah, we can go back and forth. Is that what that means? One about?
One about, yeah.
I mean, back and forth.
Yeah, back and forth. One about.
Yeah, let's get one about.
Do you want to do one or do you want to do the about?
How many do you have?
I have three.
Okay, I have essentially four. So that probably means I should go first.
And then,
okay. So I'm going to start with maybe the first book that significantly changed my mind. And I don't believe what this book teaches anymore.
Okay.
But it was instrumental in having me sort of leave what I had believed. And this is in the area of eschatology.
Okay.
So grew up in the church, grew up with kind of a default dispensational, premillennialist, pre-tribulational, probably most importantly. I wouldn't say I was super well versed in the dispensationalism part of all this, but pre-tribulational rapture view.
Yep.
So there's a rapture and then there's a second coming. So kind of a bifurcated return of the Lord, separated by the time of tribulation, 7-year tribulation, that sort of thing. And that was just kind of default. I just believed that because that's what I was taught. And sure, they had some Bible verses and I thought, oh, that, you know, that's what it is. And then when I was like first year of college, I think, a friend of mine was like, I'm not pre-trib rapture anymore. And I was like horrified. I just was thinking, man, that's awful. And then I moved into kind of mockery. It was like, well, if you want to stick around during the tribulation, you can stay, but I'm going to be up, you know, I'm going to be up in heaven. And I said, okay, so like, what is it that did this? And he handed me this book, gigantic. I mean, it was just thick book, maybe one of the biggest books that I ever read when I eventually read it. And it was called The Sign by Robert Van Kampen.
Okay.
And The Sign, looking back, it's got some really kooky stuff in it. like Adolf Hitler is going to return. He's the Antichrist and he's coming back in the future. So it's got some kooky stuff that even at the time I was like, I'm not doing that. But what it did was in the critique of the pre-tribulational rapture stuff, I went, oh, wow. Like this is actually making some really good points about these views that don't really add up. And what The Sign proposed was a view called the pre-wrath rapture of the church. And from that book, then I read a book called The Pre-Wrath Rapture of the Church by a fellow by the name of Marvin Rosenthal. And what these two books did is basically posit a new view. It's a very minority view. I don't hold this view anymore. But it was kind of my gateway out of pre-trib rapture, which was basically the view is essentially the rapture occurs not before the tribulation, but it's kind of a modified mid-trib sort of thing. Basically, they're looking at the seals of Revelation that are opened up and they say the wrath of God doesn't begin until one of the later seals. The early seals are like the wrath of the Satan on the earth. And then the Lord returns and raptures us before, after those seals, but before the wrath of God, because Christians are not owed the wrath of God.
Yeah.
Christ has taken our wrath. And it made a lot of sense, but the parts that made the most sense were really looking at the pre-trib rapture view for the first time and going, oh, like this doesn't line up. From my perspective, this doesn't line up with scripture and that sort of thing. So it was kind of the first books that took me out of pre-trib. And I was pre-wrath for a while, which kind of put me in a kind of a historical pre-millennial camp. And that opened the door for me to read better scholars like Robert Gundry and George Eldon Ladd in particular. And so I was kind of historical pre-mill and this weird kind of mid-trib, maybe post-trib rapture kind of guy. And then eventually I read The Case for Amillennialism by Kim Riddlebarger. And that put me essentially in the amill camp. It's been probably over a decade since I've spent much time looking at kind of the eschatological timelines of things. So I just say, I'm generally amill. I think in terms of like how the timeline plays out. I'm, you know, one return, I believe there's the second coming of the Lord. That's it. Yeah. There's not a bifurcated thing. And generally, I would be maybe kind of a post-tribulational, I suppose. I think there will be a personal antichrist, like a real person. I think there will be a pronounced time of trouble before the Lord returns. But that's kind of where I'm at. And it took those books to kind of walk me through.
I was reminded of something at church actually this Sunday that someone said, you can't just disagree with somebody and say, meh, I don't agree. You have to know why you don't agree. Mm. And so it was important. That's kind of how you were saying it. Like you mock somebody that you disagree with, but actually you need to know why you disagree with them. And often when you go into that, you'll find there's things you agree on.
All right. What's your first
book? Okay, my first one, I even brought the books because I feel like I needed to see the books to see them.
That's good.
My first book is Church Membership by Jonathan Lehman.
Okay.
And I'll kind of give the background to this. So I didn't grow up in the church. So my parents were first generation Christians. They became Christians when I was kind of 7 and 8 years old. So I hadn't really been to church up until that point. Went to a church in Edinburgh, the capital city of Scotland. When they became Christians, I became a Christian not long afterwards. And that church did practice membership, but I would say it practiced membership in name. My mother is still there. They still have membership. I just wouldn't say it goes to the depth that Jonathan Lehman would describe in this book. So there is a member role. People do come and vote at meetings, but it's an independent church and it just doesn't quite operate to the depth of the local embassy membership that Jonathan Lehman speaks about in his church membership book. I then went to multiple church, served churches, traveled around different things, and I was seeing membership. So I think I always thought, yep, being a member just means you go to the members' meetings and vote. That's kind of what I was taught. And then the next kind of level would be it helps the pastors out so they know how to order their visits. So that to me just meant I believe in church membership, but I don't think I believed in the body of Christ, local embassy, actually believers coming together as a set of members. And one of the things that really kind of caught my attention is how Jonathan actually defines it. I'm just going to read it out because this is the thing. I even marked it, put a star next to it. This was the thing that this kind of paragraph changed my mind. So he says, to offer a clunky definition, we say that church membership is a formal relationship between a church and a Christian characterized by the church's affirmation and oversight of a Christian's discipleship and the Christian's submission to living out his or her discipleship in the care of the church. And the reason that changed my mind was kind of twofold. One, oversight of a Christian's discipleship. I believed that. I got that. I hadn't really kind of connected with the second half, the Christian's submission to living out his or her discipleship in the care of the church. I had got that pastors had to have some oversight. There had to be like a roll call of some sort. I hadn't really grasped until reading this book that the member was willingly submitting to that leadership, being cared for, should expect care. What would that care look like? And so I was morphing then when I was reading this book away from, oh, this is about a vote, and more towards, actually, this is about me saying, I'm putting my lot in with this church and they're going to care for me and I'm going to care for them. And so for me, that happened about the middle of my ministry. So I was serving as a pastor when I read this book. I'd been maybe serving 3 years by the time I'd read this book. And so my last church that I served in, we really increased what membership meant. We increased discussion on baptism. We increased discussion on, so we call it a constitution in the UK rather than a covenant in the UK. Yeah. But we talked about what is in our constitution. What do we expect of one another? Regularly read that out when members were accepted into the church. And yeah, really, I would say kind of similar to what you were saying. I was on the journey. I was already there, but it was Lehman that kind of sealed my belief that the meaningful membership is really important in the church and a biblical doctrine as far as to how we actually care for one another. So that's one of the books. And the great thing about how Lehman writes in this book, this isn't the same for all of his books, but certainly this book, it's really simple to read.
Yeah.
It's one of those books you can read in, if you're a fast reader, an hour or two. If you're a slow reader, maybe an afternoon, and you walk away thinking, I think I know everything I need to know about church membership. Like he's just really good at laying all out. So yeah, one of my big favorites and one that changed my mind.
To reiterate, this is Church Membership, which is in the Building Healthy Churches series.
Nightmark series,
So it's the bright blue book in the little hardback series.
Yep.
I actually have a Lehman title on my list as well, which is, he's going to get a big head.
He's going to get it.
But I'm going to hold that off and share a different title now. So this is a similar time period of working through eschatology for me. One of the things I also grew up with, a kind of a default view, was just sort of a basic vanilla free will theism, kind of free will salvation. Right. And I didn't know growing up like what a Calvinist was. I didn't know if I knew a Calvinist. I just knew that Calvinism was bad because of the way the people in my churches talked about it.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember once I had a youth pastor this is when we lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And there was, I think, word that his reputation was that he was a Calvinist. Mm. And the stereotype was like, oh, Calvinists don't evangelize, et cetera. And what was really strange is, the youth pastor is maybe the most evangelistic person in our church. So for him to be the Calvinist and to be downtown doing street evangelism and all these sort of things all the time, I think that kind of had a cognitive dissonance for some folks. But I remember somebody saying, man, he's a really great youth pastor. You know, the kids really love him and everything, but I think he's a Calvinist. They kind of whisper under their voice. And so that was my first clue of like,
this might not be good.
It may not be good, but this guy is one and he's awesome. So it can't be terrible. Yeah. You know, I didn't really still know what it was. And then when I got into later high school, I was like, oh yeah, Calvinism, that's bad. You know, once I learned what it was and or at least, you know, the stereotype of it, of the view or the basic, you know, outline of the view, I was like, no, that's awful. You know, God is not a, you know, puppet master. He's not, you know, et cetera. We're not robots, all this sort of thing. And then when I was in college, around the same time that I was looking at eschatology, I worked in the Baptist bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, and there were these two guys that worked in the bookstore who were essentially best friends. I mean, they were like buddies, and their wives were really close. And one was a Southern Baptist pastor who was a Calvinist, and the other guy was a Free Will Baptist pastor. And they would argue all the time about these things. And I didn't go where the Free Will Baptist guy would go because they have certain views on eternal security and those sorts of things that I didn't even agree with at that time. So I guess I would have been maybe like a two-point Calvinist, like a lot of Southern Baptists would be. And so, but I was kind of rooting for him in these debates that would take place during the lunch breaks and things like that in the employee lunchroom. And what was really helpful to me is that these two guys who would argue with each other on this thing all the time, like when I say argue, like they would debate, they really loved each other and they were friends. And it gave me kind of a context for this debate that I think was really helpful, not just then, but even onward to be like, oh, this isn't a thing that we need to be like cutting anybody's throat about. Yeah. We can disagree and still love each other. But as I was rooting for the Free Will guy, at least as it pertains to this idea of like predestination and God's sovereignty and in the midst of regeneration and those sorts of things, little by little, I like intellectually, I'm like, the other guy's winning. Where he's going in the Bible is much more convincing. Yeah. It's like, and so I'm just sort of thinking, I really don't want this to happen. How do I get this, you know? And so eventually, I think I was like almost there, like I'm going to change my mind. And I went to lunch actually down the road from the Baptist bookstore to McDonald's with the Calvinist guy. And we're still in touch today. We talk all the time on via text. And I just said, okay, make the case. Let me just ask you a million questions and you tell me and you make the case for me because I think I'm almost there. And he made the case. And he basically, and I said, what do I read? And he said, you need to read The Holiness of God. I'm sorry, Chosen by God by R.C. Sproul. Mm-hmm. Little blue book. And it was in the Baptist bookstore, picked it up, took it home, read it. To this day, I wouldn't say it's the best book on this subject, but Chosen by God, you talk about just simply, forthrightly, plain spoken, but very intelligent and pointing you to the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that... That's R.C. Sproul across the board. But in this book itself, it was like, this is the book that just like, when I got to the end of it, I thought, holy cow, I'm a Calvinist. It took me a while, I'll be honest with you, even though I intellectually sort of became, you know, and I should say, subscribe to Reformed soteriology, because Calvinism is a very big category and includes lots of things that Baptists would not agree with. But just in terms of like, of TULIP, the five points of Calvinism. When I got to the end of the book, intellectually, I was like, okay, I believe that. And it took me a while to kind of get to an emotional affection for the view. I didn't really see the emotional intelligence of the view or the spiritual benefits necessarily. I just wanted to be right, and I wanted to believe what the Bible taught, which is a good starting point. Someone who says, hey, if the Bible teaches it, I want to believe it.
Yeah.
You can start there.
Yeah.
And Chosen by God is kind of the book that pushed me over the edge, I think.
Yeah. Again, it reminds me of the same thing, the evangelism question over it. Like hyper-Calvinists don't believe that you need to evangelize.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of those things of, why do we always have to hyper someone's view to the nth degree? And, you know, we put the extras on it, and that's not actually what they believe, generally.
Right.
Okay, my next one, I actually don't have the original version anymore, I have a new version of it, and that is The Reformed Pastor by Baxter. So I don't have the original. I gave the original one away, but I was given this one recently, which is the kind of updated and abridged version. I read this, maybe 10 years ago now, not the abridged version, the original. And then I had to read it again for your class. And what was really interesting is when I read it again, you know, eight, 9 years later, the things that had changed had been even more affirmed in reading it again. So it was kind of one of those things of a decade long decision to move to what had changed my mind had stuck. Like it hadn't kind of left me. The key thing in The Reformed Pastor by Richard Baxter that I had changed my mind on. So when I went into ministry, I basically thought it was the guy at the front that got to preach. Like, that was my thing. Pastors preach. That's what you do. I am called to being a pastor. Therefore, I am called to be a preacher. And that was it. There was no more. I didn't see any of the extras of pastoring. I just saw it as I am called to be a preacher, which made sense to me because I like speaking. I took a public speaking class in university. I've always felt comfortable at the front. I did debating, you know, so ergo, as a Christian, I must preach. and that was kind of my thing, is that pastoring meant preaching. It meant proclaiming the good news of our Lord, whether that be in a sermon or on the street or through evangelism, whatever that be. Then I read The Reformed Pastor and realized how wrong I was that was what pastoring is. And Baxter does a great job of showing that may be the public ministry, that may be the thing that you see, but really with that being on the surface, with everything else he does underneath it, almost propping that up, if you will. And there's two quotes that really kind of have sat with me for many years, and I'm just going to read them out. They're pretty short quotes, but they really help change my mind as to what a pastor does. And specifically what I'm talking about is pastoral visitation and pastoral care.
Okay.
That actually caring for the flock is one of the key things that a pastor does. So the two quotes that I kind of note down, this is coming from the abridged version, but when the people see that you genuinely love them, they will hear anything and bear anything and will follow you more easily. See that you feel it. Therefore, see that you feel a tender love for your people, and then let them feel it in your speeches and see it in your dealings. And it was that realization of, yes, a pastor will preach, but he only gets to preach and only preaches well when he loves the church behind the scenes.
Yeah.
That they will listen to him if he loves them. And then the second quote that kind of grabbed my attention is actually kind of multiple quotes put together on the same page. This is what he writes. We must labor to be acquainted with the state of all our people as fully as we can, to both know the individuals and their inclinations and the way of living. By giving or lending them books that are fit for them, we must be ready to give advice to those who come to us. A minister is not only to be about public preaching, but also to be a known counselor for his people's soul. And just those two quotes have really grasped kind of hold of me, and I've held on to them for a while. The abridged version has adjusted it slightly on that second one. But the thing that really changed my mind was reading this book and almost the sorrow of realizing my preaching will be ineffective because I don't do visitation, because I don't really care for the people. And for listeners that have listened for a while, that was my early ministry. I didn't really care for people. I kind of thought the job was being up front and being the name and, you know, we joked earlier, being the star, you know, you wheel me out for the thing at the front and then you wheel me back type thing. But reading this book really changed my heart off. Actually, what I am called to first and foremost is loving the Lord, and then second, loving the flock that he has put before me. And actually, I would argue 95% of that is done behind the scenes. And it's the 5% of preaching that people see. And the joke is, oh, you only work one day a week. And the reality is because they don't see what you do. And we've had multiple conversations even over the last couple of years of what it looks like to care for a church behind the scenes when nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
And in some senses, this book helped me fall in love with loving the church. And for me now, I've often said this, I don't know if I could serve without visitation now. 10 years ago, I didn't know if I could serve if I had to visit. And this book was the thing that changed my mind.
Amazing.
Yeah. And if you're not a big reader, because it is a significant work, original, the abridged version does a great job at pulling the key things. And then he adds just slight extras to kind of modernize a little bit the context. But I would say this is a must read for anyone in ministry. Sadly, yeah. It had to change my mind. I think that's a kind of sad change of mind that I was there in the first place, but I'm glad that I read it.
Yeah, that's good. So my next book is the Lehman book. And this is, like you said earlier, like I was there. Mm-hmm. I just needed someone to kind of help articulate. That's kind of what this one was for me, which is a newer Lehman book called One Assembly, which is essentially—
I thought you were going to say this one.
And it's short as well. And it's the argument for one service, one gathering, for the church. So it's explaining why multiple services, certainly multiple campuses, multi-site, but even multi-service is essentially multiple congregations, multiple churches. And, you know, I was pretty well convinced, like, man, we really need one gathering. And I had some kind of, you know, the biblical data, the biblical kind of rationale for that. But in this one little volume, Lehman just lays out, he goes through the lexical argument, exegetical argument, he goes through the practical argument. And it was just really helpful just in one place to see someone, okay, let me just make the case from the scriptures through wisdom. And super helpful, yeah. And it was super helpful for recently. So, you know, our church, Liberty Baptist Church, we're in multiple services right now. We're in two services, and we desire to be in one service. Some of our folks are sort of like, okay, that's fine. Some of our folks are sort of like, okay, makes sense, I guess, but why? Yeah. This seems really, it's more convenient. Lots of churches have multiple services. Why would we, you know, kind of be there? Some of us are kind of like, oh, prove it to me,
yeah.
kind of thing. And Lehman's book was super helpful in, as we were preaching through this series, I did one particular message called We Are One Family, where I just try to make the case for one service, why we want to get back to one service. And his book was really helpful in, you know, kind of helping, especially with some of the exegetical arguments and bringing in some of that detail. So again, it's not a book necessarily that it changed my mind about the view, but it really kind of solidified and kind of gave me the data that I needed for the view that I was kind of already kind of teetering
in. It's quite
in.
Technical without being technical, if that makes sense. It's not a textbook, but it does, I guess, if you had that view of, I think we should be one service, it's a book that gives you the evidence for that.
Yes. It's how would you put it? It's almost like a paper.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a, you know, a long paper.
Like a thesis on what it should be.
Yeah. So if you just have the preference, until you have this... Mm-hmm.
That's
you know,
way.
This rationale, you just have a preference. Oh, yeah, one service. I would prefer that. We are in the same room. It's great. This actually gives you sort of the biblical and cultural and theological rationale for it. So, One Assembly by Jonathan Lehman.
So my last one is coming completely out of left field.
All right. I'm excited.
And I'll tell you right now, I was extremely skeptical when I read this book. And here's why. On the back page, it says business self-help.
Oh.
And I was like, nope.
Man.
The word self-help. So the book is Crucial Conversations.
Okay.
Here at Midwestern Seminary, our staff in our institutional relations department read a business kind of leadership book pretty much every semester. I'm just going to be really blunt and honest with our listeners. Most of them are Gumpf.
What is Gumpf?
Gumpf is just nonsense.
Like Forrest Gump? Okay.
Just nonsense. It's just like a Scottish word for just nonsense.
Okay.
Mainly because I did a master's in economics and read a lot of business books. They're all the same.
Okay.
And they're all a Gumpf. So basically, when I got this Crucial Conversations and it was selected for us, I made my feelings known, especially with this lovely two-word
self-help.
What's
the name of the author?
There's multiple authors.
Oh, I get it.
Joseph Grenny, Kerry Patterson, Ron McMillan, Al Switzler, Emily Gregory. There is some potential connotation that some of the authors are Christians. There's definitely elements of that coming through in the book. Here's what it's about, and this is why it was chosen. Crucial Conversations is basically about when a serious conversation needs to happen between two parties, that stakes are high, that emotions are running high, there's difference of opinions, and this could blow up. Or it already has blown up and it stops progression happening. Progression of the business, progression of relationship. Examples are taken from the business world as well as the family world. And this is about how do you have that crucial conversation to change the trajectory from something that is going very negative to something that will actually be positive. Again, makes total sense in the business world to have that type of book. And actually, a lot of the book, there's things I disagree with. Specifically, it talks about in every conversation, you need to think about what you want out of it. So, which is quite a self-centered way
it's
of thinking.
Very much a self-help
Exactly.
Approach,
think about what you want and then go and get it. So there's a lot in this book I don't endorse.
Sure.
But here's something this book does really well. It does the subject matter excellently. The book just so clearly defines why conversations go so badly and how to resolve them. Now, there's, let's say, it doesn't do this, but let's say there's 10 steps of maybe of them, six I would agree with, and there's four I'm like, that's just a bit of nonsense. But one thing this book, it changed my mind on two things. Number one, it's not a Christian book per se, and it is on the self-helpy side, and so it kind of feels icky in that sense. But it changed my mind in realizing you don't just have to read Christian books. Kind of my background has been mainly, I just read Christian books.
Like Christian movies.
Like Christian movies. I actually watch a lot of non-Christian movies as well. But it changed my mind of realizing you can chew the meat and spare the bones. There is an option to read something and go, huh, okay, I can see the beauty of this. That's nonsense. I'm just going to toss that. You have to be careful with it.
Yeah.
But that changed my mind in realizing I don't need to be bigoted against non-Christian material. Second thing, and I would phrase it this way. The book doesn't phrase it this way, but I phrase it this way. It changed my mind on stewarding conversations. So I talk a lot. I talk to just about everybody on campus here. Someone quoted me as being aggressively connected.
Okay.
Which is basically code for I literally talk to everybody.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't know, conversations are free flowing for me. I don't get nervous in them and I just talk to people. But this book reminded me of stewarding those conversations. It reminded me of Sam Bierig, who works here, Dean Bierig, his book, No Neutral Words, of stewarding your words. Well, this book talks about stewarding your conversations, that actually every conversation is meaningful and you have an ability to take a conversation and have a trajectory that's positive or a trajectory that is negative. And how you approach that conversation will often determine which direction it goes. And so there was even one section that talked about a husband and wife. Things were not going well and a conversation needed to happen. And it gave the example of the husband basically saying, like, you're wrong and this is how things should change. I remember even reading it going, what an idiot. Like, you should not have that conversation. But then it dawned on me, how many times do we have conversations where we just walk blindly into them? And then it gives you a different example of how he might approach that conversation. And again, it seems corny and fake, but even just reading it, I thought, man, there's a lot of thought going into how you should actually respond to something like this. So it's not like an amazing endorsement. I wouldn't say go out and buy it. I would say for free copies given to you type thing.
Okay, wow.
But it's the question was, how did it, books that changed our mind?
Yeah.
This book changed my mind on terms of the material I should read, but also just, I got to watch my conversations. Mm. It's not just my words. I've got to watch how often I talk to certain people, how I go into those conversations, how I guide those conversations. And if anything, this book changed my mind in the opposite direction to what it wanted. It said you should go into conversations thinking, what do you want out of them? And if I'm honest, that's probably how I went into most conversations. I was like, tick, you know, I've done that for this book. But actually reading this book made me feel really awful about that, because as I read it in a self-help book, I was like, this is awful. Like, I don't want to go into a conversation thinking, what can I get out of this?
Yeah.
And so it changed my mind to not what can I get out of this conversation for myself, but rather the line that kept coming back to me, I've actually written in the book multiple times, what would glorify God in this conversation? Mm. And so this book, it changed my mind, but not in the way it probably wanted it to go.
Now, for the subject matter, it's a pretty thick book.
The easiest way to sell 5 million copies of a book about crucial conversations is write crucial conversations on every page 10 times. So it's just, it covers a lot of similar ground.
Somewhat repetitive.
Exactly. But those in institutional relations in our seminary here kind of know my feeling on these types of books. I made them known. So they'd be surprised to hear me say that it changed my mind.
So I was that guy once as well. I worked in that department, and I remember, you know, reading these books with the leadership project or leadership team. And I was the curmudgeon about them as well. In fact, I had to get a little talking to once.
But I was like, just give me the Bible. There's leaders in the Bible. But be very clear, I am not recommending self-help books.
Okay.
The question was, how did your books have changed our mind? It changed my mind.
Well, my final needs is to be a maybe big one. The most crucial anti-self-help book that I have ever read. And yeah, it's a little book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer called Life Together, which I've talked a lot about, probably outside the Bible. the most impactful book on my life. And no, I don't agree with everything Dietrich Bonhoeffer believed or taught. And I don't necessarily agree with everything in this little book, but the bulk of it has been so shaping and so charging for me. And the time when I read it, like if you're just thinking about a book that like changed everything, I was in an attractional megachurch. I was going through a really rough period of my own life, depression and all sorts of things, lots of brokenness in my life, which I was hiding from everyone. Nobody at the church knew about it. And I didn't know a whole lot of people in the church, but I was in a men's kind of small group. That almost overstates it because we didn't really study the Bible together. It was essentially guys who played board games together. And I'm not a gamer. You probably know this. I'm notorious at our church as a non-gamer. So my wife hosts these game nights, and she hosts them on nights when I'm at elders meeting or other places because I am definitely not a gamer. So I was a part of this men's small group that was all these board game guys, and I would just hang out with them because I wanted friends. And they were friendly, and so I would hang with them. We did a retreat together and everything. But we would read books together, and we would talk about the books. And I don't know who suggested it. I might have even suggested it just hearing because I knew about Bonhoeffer from working in the Baptist bookstore or something. But in any event, we started reading life together, and man, it like rearranged my protons. Like I did not even know that just the possibility of what we might call today like a gospel culture, what Ray Ortlund calls gospel culture. It was so foreign and so opposite of what I was experiencing, some because of the ministry philosophy of the churches that I was trained in and had been a part of and was a part of when I read the book, sort of the attractional secret church, very pragmatic, very consumeristic, not experiencing a whole lot of community, despite the fact there's lots of people there. I wouldn't say we had a lot of, life on life community and the experience of church. And so that was foreign to me. But even some of the stuff personally challenging that Bonhoeffer talks about, he who is alone with his sin is utterly alone.
Yeah.
Man, like that just rocked me from the inside out. That was me.
Yeah.
He said, even despite enjoying the fellowship, the person who isn't known will feel alone. And that's how I was. I'm with these guys. This is, reading books together, and they didn't know me. They didn't know what I was going through. Mm-hmm. They just knew the version of myself that I was presenting to them. And it just spoke so much to my heart. And it gave me this glimpse of like, could this be real? Could this, and no church is perfect. No church gets this, 100% right. But to be working towards it, to be walking towards it, it just gave me a vision for what a gospel culture would look like, what the gospel can do. The book doesn't use the language of gospel centrality or anything like that. But it was my first kind of, before my gospel wakefulness, in a sense, this was like an a wakefulness to the possibility of a gracious community.
Yeah.
And it didn't just change my mind. It really changed my heart and changed my life. Mm. So those are our books. Ross has got Church Membership by Jonathan Lehman, The Reformed Pastor by Richard Baxter, and Crucial Conversations by a variety of people. I've got The Sign. We're not necessarily recommending all these books. Are you? No. Well, you are maybe. I'm not recommending all of my books.
No.
They're just the books that changed my mind.
I'm not recommending Crucial Conversations. Okay.
So I was about to say The Sign by Robert Van Campen. I am not recommending that. I don't even know if it's still in print. I've never seen it. I don't know anyone else who shares the pre-wrath view. Case for Amillennialism by Kim Riddlebarger. I would recommend that book. Holiness of God by R.C. Sproul. I would recommend that book. One Assembly by Jonathan Lehman. I would definitely recommend that book. And Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I would very, very, very much recommend that book. And that's been today's episode. If you've enjoyed the podcast, your listener, give us a good review on Apple Podcasts. Give us some all the stars on Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Let people know on social media, et cetera. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church. You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.